This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London. I'm James Kamara-Sami. It is the 1st of February, the day that Donald Trump promised to take what he's called the most beautiful word in the dictionary, tariffs, and turn it into action. You might call it T-Day. Well, as of now, there's been no official news that the tariffs or import duties have come into effect on America's three main trading partners, Mexico, Canada and China. But the Mexicans and Canadians are expecting a 25% tariff on all US exports with a lower rate for Canadian oil, while China is expecting a 10% import duty on all goods that it ships to America. Now, Canadian media is now reporting the 25% tariffs will come into effect there on Tuesday. Speaking to reporters on Friday, Mr. Trump said the measure was primarily punishment for what he called the three countries' role in the illegal flow of the synthetic opioid fentanyl.
It's a pure economic. We have big deficits with, as you know, with all three of them. And in one case, they're sending massive amounts of fentanyl, killing hundreds of thousands of people a year with the fentanyl. And in the other two cases, they're making it possible for this poison to get in, number one. And number two, we have big deficits, and it's something we're doing, and we'll possibly very substantially increase it.
Deficits and fentanyl. Well, with fears of a new trade war looming, one leading contender to become Canada's next Prime Minister, Mark Carney, has condemned President Trump's approach, saying that Canada would not yield to intimidation.
President Trump thinks Canada will cave in. We will never, ever bow down to a bully. Canadians will always stick together. And we won't stand by as tariffs hurt our workers and their families. Canadians need to remain united.
Meanwhile, China's foreign ministry has warned Donald Trump that a trade war has no winners, even though the new 10% tariffs on Chinese goods is a far cry from the 60% that Mr. Trump threatened on the campaign trail. But with China's annual exports to the United States currently worth around $500 billion, Beijing is still bracing for the extra import duties. Bracing, but also preparing. Over the past year, thousands of Chinese businesses have moved their production abroad, as our China correspondent Laura Bicker now reports.
This is the sound of an all-American cowboy boot taking shape. They were once crafted to conquer the Wild West, but these carefully stitched designs are now made in China.
When things get busy, the whole factory gets packed with people, shoulder to shoulder. But these days, there are fewer staff at each process.
Mr. Peng has worked at the factory since he was 15. But more than 20 years on, he's worried about dwindling orders. US buyers don't want to risk more of Donald Trump's tariffs on Chinese-made goods.
In the end, it is the workers at the bottom who suffer. With higher tariffs, we have higher costs.
This leather boots factory can make, when it's busy, 70,000 pairs of handcrafted leather boots in a month. But right now I'm looking at lots and lots of empty tables. They're actually having to make French military boots to try to keep the factory going. Each shoe is hand-polished at the end of 100 different processes. The owners have thought about moving production to Southeast Asia, but they would lose their skilled workforce.
As you can see, the workers here are like family to each other. If we were to move, they'd lose their jobs and end up unemployed.
Other Chinese companies, however, are on the move. Parts of Cambodia have given itself to Beijing. Half the country's investment now flows from China. You can tell me a bit about the factory. So what are we seeing here?
The factory has only been running for a few months, so I only have these workers here for now. Once we are fully staffed, there will be 1,500 workers. All of our products are for export, 100%.
Huang Zhaodong makes clothes for US firms like Walmart and Costco, and he's getting ready for more orders. His factory and his workers are in Cambodia, but most of the materials still come from China. Successes like this one increase China's influence across Southeast Asia.
Here on the streets of Phnom Penh, the flashing neon signs are not just in Khmer. They are mostly in Chinese.
Trump's tariffs have not stopped China's rise. Beijing has simply gone elsewhere to do business. China may lose some money in this battle, but it's still gaining power and influence.
And that was Laura Bicker reporting there. So what of the third country targeted by these tariffs, Mexico? Well, I've been discussing the prospect of these new import duties with Jorge Castaneda. He's a former Mexican foreign minister, now a professor at New York University and Sciences Po in Paris. And with Miles Yu, director of the China Center at the Hudson Institute and an advisor to the US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on China during the first Trump administration. So what does he think President Trump is trying to achieve with these tariffs?
If you are a president, get into the White House right now, you will face the following situation. There is a tremendous trade imbalance between U.S. and many of the countries, including Mexico, Canada, and China. What Donald Trump tries to do is to sort of reclaim the United States as not only a commercial capital center, but also an industrial capital center. That's one of the reasons why tariff, he thinks, is going to attract foreign investment back to the United States. So he believed that tariffs can really mitigate that kind of problem by collecting a lot of tariffs to do that. And to be frankly, you know, obviously, tariffs has become an instrument of American foreign policy as a sort of a bargaining leverage to force other governments to change what he believes is bad behavior.
Why only 10% on China? He talked about 60% during the election campaign. What's his thinking there?
I think the thinking is we already have a pretty heavy tariffs on some of the key aspects of trade with China. So what he tried to do is to use this as a leverage to tell the Chinese, ultimately, we're going to levy 60%, 100%, 200% if necessary, but he's going to do it incrementally.
Jorge Castaneda, what is the impact going to be on Mexico if these 25% tariffs come in?
Well, if they are across the board and they last more than just a few days, I think the impact will be devastating. Mexico has 80% of its exports going to the United States, and it has a very open economy, meaning that foreign trade represents more than 50% of GDP. So you can just do the numbers. The impact of a 25% tariff on Mexican exports to the U.S. is absolutely devastating for the economy, probably leading to a recession this year, which is already coming, perhaps.
So if they are so devastating, these tariffs, will they then have the desired effect in the White House? Will they have an influence on what Mexico does in terms of illegal migration and in terms of fentanyl and stopping fentanyl getting across the border?
Yes, of course, this kind of tariff would force Mexico, which does not have the capability, the strength to resist a decision of this sort. There may be some counter tariffs as retaliation, but they are meaningless given the difference in size between the two economies. The problem, of course, is that how do you measure these things? Fewer migrants. Well, what does fewer mean? None at all? No Mexicans, no non-Mexicans, over what kind of period of time? What does eliminating fentanyl shipments to the United States mean? It's not unlikely that these tariffs will be counterproductive for Mexico in the sense that plunging the economy into a recession will probably encourage immigration and encourage drug trafficking.
Miles, you, what about that? What about those counter effects, not just within Mexico, but within the United States, because clearly tariffs are paid by U.S. importers and they are likely to hurt U.S. consumers?
I have a slightly different perspective. You know, the number one problem facing the United States is a threat from China. So China's counterpunch is to exert its influence and extend its illicit activities through third countries. In this case, fentanyl, Mexico, and they're going to build this huge automobile plants in Mexico to make cheap cars to export to the United States. So what I'm saying is, I think the purpose of Trump's tariffs is not to deliberately destroy the economies of Canada and Mexico. It's to make sure that the world must end this silly neutrality. You cannot really sit in the middle.
Let me get your perspective, Jorge Castaneda, on that point.
Well, I think in the case of Mexico, it's been very clear for the past three administrations, including this one, that clearly they have taken the United States' side against China. Miles was mentioning the question of the car plants. In fact, there are no Chinese car plants in Mexico. We do have too large a trade deficit with China. Do you want to establish a 25% tariff and plunge the Mexican economy into recession over a trade deficit in between Mexico and the United States of $150 billion, of which maybe $20 billion has to do with China? Is it really worth it?
Let me just ask you both finally, Miles, you, are you positive that these tariffs will come in? And if so, how long do you think they will be in place?
I think, you know, the ending date is indefinite and it depends on the situation. And I think the minister was right. There is no Chinese investment in Mexico. But that's only after President Trump intervened. And so the idea that somehow you got hundreds of thousands, millions of people crossing Mexican territory, entered the United States territory. And unless those problems were solved, I don't see the ending day.
Just to follow up on that, what is it that you think that Donald Trump will want to be able to show to prove that his policy has worked?
Whenever he makes a point about this border safety, politicians in Mexico and many other countries would counter with basically not correct answers. And so they say, oh, it's all Americans' fault. So that argument do not resonate with American, particularly with a resurrected president like Trump. So I think both sides should really calm down and talk about the real issues.
Jorge Castaneda, your view on the duration of these tariffs and what might ensue from them?
They might not necessarily remain across the board indefinitely. They may be selective at the beginning or become selective over a short period of time. And I think what Donald Trump will try to do is to show drops in migration encounters, drops in fentanyl shipments and deaths. But unfortunately, I think if the tariffs are implemented, they will last sufficient time to be very, very harmful to the Mexican economy and to Mexican society in general.
We heard there from Jorge Castaneda, former Mexican foreign minister, and from Miles Yu, an advisor to the US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on China during the first Trump administration. You're listening to the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour, coming to you live from London with James Kamarasamy. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from London with James Kamarasamy. The ceasefire deal in Gaza is still holding. Today, in the latest exchange of Palestinian prisoners for Israeli hostages, three hostages, Yaden Bibas, Ofer Calderon, and the US Israeli citizen Keith Siegel, were set free by Hamas. Before they were driven back to Israel, they appeared on a stage in Khan Yunis in the southern Gaza Strip, surrounded by masked Hamas gunmen in front of a banner depicting killed leaders of that organization. An official from the Israeli Health Ministry, Haga Mizrahi, said the freed hostages were undergoing initial medical evaluations.
This is an exciting day for all of us. After so many days in a difficult and complex reality, we must all remember that it is an emotionally and medically challenging event for those who returned, their families, and the families of all the captives and the people in Israel and abroad.
Meanwhile, in the occupied West Bank, there were jubilant scenes in Ramallah. Celebrations there as 183 Palestinian prisoners were released under the terms of the agreement. Well, I've been hearing more about the day's events from the BBC's Wira Davis, who's in Hostages Square in Tel Aviv.
We had three hostages released today, Keith Siegel, Ofer Calderon, and perhaps most significantly, Yarden Bibas. Now, he is the father of children and has a wife, and it's widely believed that they were killed during captivity in Gaza. So for his wider family, today has been a very bittersweet moment. And that's been sort of, I think, felt around this square in Tel Aviv. Of course, it's a joyous occasion for them, the release of the hostages. But the circumstances surrounding Mr. Bibas's release are very difficult for many people.
And as you say, the Palestinian prisoners, more than 180 of them, also released as well. What are we hearing about the prisoners, who they were, and what the mood has been amongst those on the West Bank?
The most significant thing about those 180 Palestinian prisoners released today is that more than half of them were actually detained and arrested after the events of October the 7th and were never charged. They were held in what the Israelis called preventative detention. And that has to be driven home, because the Israeli now is that all of the Palestinians being released under this deal are terrorists. Well, it's clear that many people have been lesser offences, actually undeclared offences, because they've never been charged. So it's important to say that along with those Palestinians who've been convicted of very serious offences, including murder, some of whom were released to the occupied West Bank today, there are others, many more, certainly today, who were swept up after the events of October the 7th.
And I guess we're at a point where this process is now well underway, thoughts turning to what comes next, whether the ceasefire can hold, whether the next phases can take place. And we hear Benjamin Netanyahu making a pretty important journey to Washington, D.C.
This process has borne fruit. Not only are hostages being released, Palestinian prisoners being released, but the Rafah border between Egypt and Gaza was partially opened today, allowing, poorly and very sick and wounded Palestinians out for treatment in Gaza, in Egypt, sorry. It was a drop in the ocean, but another signal that the process is working. And that is what many people now, I think, in Israel are saying, is that this ceasefire is working. One person I spoke to now says, just do the math. You know, a ceasefire leads to hostages releases. There is a significant body politic in Israel who do have the ear of Benjamin Netanyahu, who want the war to restart because they say Hamas isn't yet defeated. And that will be really interesting to see what kind of pressure, if any, is put on Mr. Netanyahu in Washington. For example, do they discuss Trump's proposal that Palestinians, thousands of them, should seek refuge and be taken to neighbouring Arab countries? An idea that in the last few hours has been again completely rejected by Arab nations.
And that was the BBC's Wira Davis speaking to me from Tel Aviv. It is a rare and valuable piece of scientific memorabilia, and it's been hanging anonymously on a wall at the University of Nottingham in central England. The item in question is a blackboard covered with equations written by Albert Einstein and signed by the genius himself. But with the ravages of time and of construction work putting Einstein's dusty jottings at risk, scientists at the university are now trying to rehouse the blackboard. I've been hearing more from Dr. Emma Chapman. She's a cosmologist at the university's physics department.
So just under 100 years ago, the University of Nottingham invited Albert Einstein to come and tell everybody in the physics department all about his new theories of general relativity, which are the idea of how space-time works, how the universe works. He was friends with one of the heads of department here. And so on the evening, he was due to give a lecture. He did turn up late, which is very Einstein. He ended up getting distracted by Isaac Newton's house in Lincolnshire on the way. But he did turn up. And what he did was he spoke in German about all of these theories, all of these mathematical equations. And as he was doing so, we had one of the physicists actually translating from German to English. And also he was transcribing the mathematical equations on the blackboard.
A blackboard which Einstein then signed.
Yes, that's correct. So it's one of very few blackboards in existence and the only signed one that we know of at all. There's one more in the UK at the University of Oxford. There were two, but somebody unfortunately cleaned one of them. So this is a very, very rare item and it's got a wonderful signature and a date right at the bottom of it. You can look at it and you can see all of the text. You can identify the equations that describe a black hole. You can see his signature. So it's not beyond repair by a long way. But what we do need is somebody to come in and just tell us what we need to do.
And no chance of it being cleaned because it is preserved, isn't it?
Thankfully, yes, we've had the common sense here at Nottingham to put it behind glass so that nobody can make that mistake. But it's definitely in need of some TLC. It's not at the kind of state-of-the-art conservation levels that we need it to be, that it deserves to be at.
So how concerned are you at the moment that the glass isn't good enough?
I mean, honestly, I'm quite concerned, and it's not just the glass, it's that it's fixed to a wall in a fairly crude manner of a very little used meeting room here at the physics department. And we're currently having lots of construction work done. And so every time one of the drills goes off, I'm having kittens thinking, oh my Lord, chalk particles could be floating off this thing. So I think, you know, anybody from a museum would just come in and sob if they actually saw the state that we have it in at the minute. We've tried really hard, but you know what? As physicists, this is not our expertise.
No. Well, maybe the construction bit could be, but what about what you're planning to do now? You've clearly identified the problem. What are you hoping the solution will be?
Well, we're hoping to conserve it, to recover any damage done, but also at the same time bring it out so that the public and the students, most importantly, can actually see this piece of heritage, because at the minute, as I said, it's in a very little used corner of the physics department. You can honestly go through your entire degree at Nottingham not know it's there at all. So the idea is to bring this piece of history out into the public domain, but we need money to do that. I'm only 2 years in, 3 years in actually, at the University of Nottingham, and I spent the first 2 years not knowing it was there, and I still to this day don't understand how that's happened. We even have the piece of chalk that he wrote on the blackboard with. I think it's just a case of we're so used to having it there, it's kind of like a shrug and a, oh, do you want to go see Einstein's blackboard on open days? And people go up there and they go, what? All generations are absolutely floored by this object. But the state of higher education as it is, we simply don't have the money to preserve a blackboard, however important it is. And it's lovely to see the building blocks of theories that we still haven't got a hold on today.
Typical Einstein turning up late, that's what I thought as well. Dr. Emma Chapman, a cosmologist working in the physics department at the University of Nottingham. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Welcome back to NewsHour. Nearly 3 years since Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine, President Trump has warned President Putin of high tariffs and further sanctions if he fails to end the war. That tougher talk has been welcomed by Kaya Kallas, the European Union's new foreign policy chief. She's been speaking exclusively to my colleague Julian Warwicker. He asked her whether she believed the proposal by some members of the Trump administration to freeze the Ukraine conflict would work.
That has already been tried. I mean, freezing the conflict is just to the benefit of Russia, who wants to have a pause to regroup and attack again. So I think we need to be much stronger. And I'm also happy to see that President Trump's statements have been quite strong, putting the pressure on Putin where it should be. Economically, we see that their economy is not doing well. We should also pressure them politically on the international fora. And of course, we should also help and support Ukraine so that they can defend themselves.
So no to a freeze, and the option of NATO membership should still be on the table.
NATO membership is the strongest security guarantee there is. So this has to be the option, because we have also decided in NATO that Ukraine's path is to NATO membership. Otherwise, you know, all the discussions about security guarantees, the countries then need to answer the question, what are the security guarantees? Like, really, not on paper, but in reality, that would provide peace and security for that country.
And are you confident that the Americans see it that way?
I had a very good call with the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, and he was definitely emphasizing the same things, putting pressure on Putin. Whether it is the understanding of the whole administration, I don't know, but I certainly do hope so.
I mean, there are some European leaders, and you will know this very well, indeed, some from the Baltics, who fear that their legitimate security concerns about Russia might be overlooked if Washington speaks to Moscow over their heads. Are you worried about that?
Of course, the question is, of any kind of deal needs to have also clear understanding how this deal is implemented. And I can't see any any option on the table where the Europeans are not part of any kind of agreement implementation, because it's going on the European soil. In order to have an agreement, we definitely need to have Europe around the table, because it's not only about Ukraine, but it's also about the European security architecture. And it's clear that we as European Union have been giving a lot of support to Ukraine, over 134 billion euros. It's actually making us the biggest donor for Ukraine. So we are doing this on our side, but it's clear that we also need to be around those tables where any kind of security architecture is discussed.
That was Kaja Kallas, the EU's foreign policy chief, and she was speaking to my colleague Julian Warwicker. You're listening to the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour, coming to you live from London with James Kamara-Sami. We began the programme with one key component of Donald Trump's foreign policy, tariffs, and we're going to turn to another now, threats of territorial conquest. One of the targets that's apparently in Mr. Trump's sights is the Panama Canal, and Panama happens to be the first stop on the new US Secretary of State Marco Rubio's first trip overseas. The BBC's Tom Bateman is in Panama City, so how unusual is it for a US Secretary of State to kick off his travels in this region?
Well, it hasn't happened for over 100 years that a US Secretary of State has come to Latin America on their first trip. So, yeah, I mean, near unprecedented. And I think that gives you a sense of what the Trump administration is trying to say and do here. Two big points, really. One is about migration. I think we can expect to see images of Marco Rubio in front of, you know, repatriation flights and things like that during the course of this trip. That's what they want people to see, as migrants being sent back from the US to this particular part of the world. The other thing, and this comes from a Secretary of State who is hawkish on China, is that a big part of this trip is about trying to counter the influence of China in this region as far as the US is concerned. And that then takes you to what President Trump has said about the Panama Canal here. Because, of course, remember, in the run-up to his inauguration and during his inaugural address even, he said that he wanted America to take back the Panama Canal for itself. Now, that has triggered, and my sense, you know, over the last sort of day or so of being in this country, a backlash among Panamanians, not least from President Mulino, who has said that that is not happening. It will remain Panamanian, and has said, even as Mr. Rubio arrives here, that that issue is not up for negotiation.
And what about the people of Panama? What do they make of it?
This has aroused deeply patriotic feelings here, because, you know, all Panamanians you speak to, almost without exception, feel very strongly about the Panama Canal, that it's their resource, that it's their economic benefit, and it should remain in their hands. There were protests in the run-up to Mr. Rubio's arrival, pretty small scale, and one of them led by a well-known union leader, but evolving into clashes with security forces and some tear gas fired in one particular case. They were burning effigies of Donald Trump and Marco Rubio. So there is a very strong sense of feeling. I think this, what this comes down to in the end, is whether or not this is simply President Trump's trying to start with a maximalist negotiating strategy. What he wants to do is counter the influence of China, which has invested heavily in ports and infrastructure around the canal. It doesn't own and operate it, as Mr. Trump has suggested. That is not true. But there is certainly a concern among the Americans about the ability of the Chinese ultimately to control this critical resource in the, you know, say, in the event of conflict or a trade war. But the question is whether or not the Americans have sort of overplayed their hand from the start by going out with this approach saying they want to take back the canal itself, because clearly for Panamanians, that's something that is just totally off the table.
The BBC's Tom Bateman in Panama City. Well, on Sunday, Mr. Rubio meets President Marino of Panama and the administrator of the Panama Canal Authority. That's a government agency which manages and operates the canal. Ilia Espino de Marotta is the deputy administrator of the Panama Canal Authority. And I asked her how important tomorrow's meeting is.
I think it's a very important meeting because of all the press and everything that's been said about the Panama Canal. From the canal point of view, I think it's very important that some of the things that have been said are learned from the first hand, that not necessarily have they been presented to the media.
What precisely? What is the, as you would see it, the false impressions that you want to try to counter?
Okay. It's very important that it's known that the Panama Canal is run by Panamanians. We are an autonomous entity of the state. And I mean, I've been working in the canal for 39 years, so I can assure you that the Panama Canal is run by Panamanians and it's an autonomous entity of the country. I mean, we're a very transparent entity. You can see how much the tolls are. And actually, the U.S. military and auxiliary vessels get priority to come through the canal, and they don't have to pay a reservation. So on the contrary, if there is any country or state that gets favored, it's the United States, and it's because of the treaties. It was stated that they will have priority in passage, and they don't require a reservation, neither to pay for a reservation. So those are some of the things that I think are not being very clear portrayed by the media.
Well, it's not so much the media as President Trump, who has said that Panama needs to reduce its exorbitant transit fees. And you're saying that there are not transit reservation fees for American vessels.
Right. But that's also very important to know that the Panama Canal is not a monopoly. We do have competitive routes. People don't need to use the Panama Canal. We are just one of the alternatives. You can go through the Cape of Horn, Cape of Good Faith. You can go through the Suez Canal. You can use the West Coast ports and use the intermodal system. So the Panama Canal, whenever they adjust the rates, we make certain that we remain a very competitive route, the alternate routes.
Now, you said that the Panama Canal is operated and controlled very specifically by Panama. You know, again, that the accusation coming from the Trump administration is that Chinese companies are operating ports at both ends of the canal, that China has an oversized influence on the canal. And those ports do exist, don't they? They are controlled by Hong Kong-based company.
That's correct. Those ports were put out to bid by the Panama Maritime Authority, which is not us, and they were awarded as a bid process in 1997. So they've been here for quite a long time. We've had no problems. Another fact that is very important to realize is that any vessel that goes into either the Huntington ports or the Port of Singapore Authority, which is right across the channel from the Chinese port, all the vessels are managed by Panama Canal pilots, because every vessel that moves within Panama Canal's waters needs pilotage of Panama Canal pilots. And they bring the vessels inside and out of the ports. We, the Panama Canal, are the ones that do the scheduling of when the ships come in and go out.
Can I ask about some of the other accusations about Chinese influence that has been leveled from the American side? China investing in energy-related facilities along the canal, China using water management efforts to gain a foothold in the Panama Canal zone, China constructing a huge bridge that spans the canal. What do you say to those points when they are made by the U.S. government?
Okay, any development that is within Panama Canal patrimony needs to get a compatibility permit by the Panama Canal. I don't recall any of those projects that you mentioned, except the bridge. I'm not sure what's the company that is building the bridge, because that contract has kind of gone through a couple of iterations. So that's a contract that has been awarded by the government to the bidding competition. Now, regardless of who's building that bridge over the canal, the Panama Canal, to give compatibility, puts certain commitments for the construction of the bridge. And we make sure that whatever we put as a requirement to give a compatibility permit is complied with. So all of the requirements to make sure that it's a safe project when it's built over the canal.
How confident are you then that you can sit down, or the president and the canal administrator can sit down with the U.S. Secretary of State and convince him that you are right and the Trump administration is wrong?
Well, I don't think it's a matter of convincing. It's a matter of looking at the records. I mean, we've been operating the canal for 25 years very successfully. We built an expanded canal. We opened up markets for LNG, bigger LPG vessels. I mean, I think the 25 years of record of administration of the Panama Canal speaks for themselves. I think it's a matter of record and objectivity and not convincing.
That was Ilia Espino de Marotta. She's the Panama Canal Authority's deputy administrator. In East Africa, the march of the M23 rebels in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo is continuing. After the Rwanda-backed rebels captured the city of Goma several days ago, that's the capital of North Kivu province, they're now heading south towards the capital of South Kivu, Bukavu. Hundreds of casualties have been left in the wake of their advance. Today, the DRC's health ministry said that 773 bodies had been identified in morgues in and around Goma. Well, we can hear now from Bukavu, which appears to be the rebels' next major target. Therese Mema Mapenzi is the director of the Centre Olami Bukavu. It's a Roman Catholic organisation that works with women and children. So what's she been hearing about the M23 rebels' progress towards her city?
Since yesterday and the day before yesterday, we heard that the M23 are fighting in the mountains of Kalehe. And Kalehe is more or less at 80 to 100 kilometers from Bukavu, where I am based. And since we knew that they took Goma, people here in Bukavu are really afraid that they may take at any time Bukavu, but also afraid of the fightings that can happen in Bukavu, because in South Kivu, we have so many armed groups, and some may be on the side of the National Army or in the side of the M23. So we are afraid of this situation.
So what are civilians doing? Are people leaving Bukavu?
Those who are in Bukavu are moving to Bujumbura, to Kigali, and others, they go far to cross the border in Tanzania.
So they are moving some to Rwanda, some to Tanzania, some to Burundi. They are leaving, leaving the DRC.
Yes, they are leaving the DRC. For those who have means, and those who do not have means, they have to stay. The fear is if the M23 reach Bukavu, it means that the fighting will be high comparing to what happened to Goma. It is really complicated, and this is the fear of the community.
What are you seeing when it comes to the presence of the Congolese army, the DRC army in Bukavu at the moment? Are they a visible presence in the streets?
Since the morning, we saw some cars going and coming back. We don't know where they are going, but it shows the sign of war, the sign of fear, the sign of insecurity in the city. And also the shops are closed. The bank are not working well. The markets, they are opening, but people are afraid of any kind of looting. The market is now very, very expensive. So the vulnerable people, they don't have possibility to get food. And all this impacts on the humanitarian situation in Bukavu.
Are you going to stay there, Therese, if the M23 approach Bukavu?
Myself and my family, we don't know where to go. Because if I go to Rwanda, which is in somehow our enemy, I don't know if I'm safe there. And as we work for the civil society, sometimes we speak out to denounce what is going on. So we know that we are subject of any insecurity issue, but we don't know where to go.
That was Therese Mema Mapenzi there from the Centre Olami Bukavu in Bukavu. You're listening to the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour, coming to you live from London with James Kamarasamy. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from London with James Kamarasamy. During their long insurgency, they attacked it. Now they own it. The Taliban have today taken over the running of one of Kabul's best-known luxury hotels, the Serena. It was run for nearly 20 years by the Aga Khan Fund for Economic Development in the Afghan capital. It was popular with business travellers and with foreign guests. Well, one foreign guest frequently in the Afghan capital who knows the hotel well is our own Lise Doucette, and she's on the line now. Hi, Lise. You know it well. I think you were there when it reopened. So tell us a little bit about its history.
Well, Jamie, I should begin by saying that, of course, the Serena Hotel, the only luxury hotel left in Afghanistan, was For most Afghans, the vast majority, just a symbol, it wasn't a reality. Staying there was far beyond their means. But I remember when it opened with a great flourish and ribbon cutting in 8th of November 2005 by the then President Hamid Karzai, the Aga Khan, head of the worldwide community of Ismaili Muslims, and really a promoter of Islamic architecture. And the Serena, the Kabul Serena Hotel was part of that chain. And it became a symbol of a new Afghanistan that would attract not just tourists, but investors, foreign leaders. And this was a place for them to stay. So it marked a new turning point for Afghanistan. And I remember meeting the first general manager who came from China. And he said to me that he had told his wife, he was in Beijing, and he said, I'm going to be the first general manager of the Kabul Serena Hotel because I want to be part of that new time in Afghanistan.
But, of course, it also attracted attacks by the Taliban when they had their insurgency.
Yes, what a difference a few decades makes. It became, for the Taliban, it was not a symbol of progress, but a symbol of decadence, of the infidels, of course, most of all, the foreign troops that were also in Afghanistan in growing numbers. So they became a very high-profile target, and was actually astonishing at the time, Jamie. There was like walls of security, and this is where the Taliban started mounting very complex attacks, ramming vehicles into the high metal and wooden gates, suicide bombers going up, managing to scale the walls, throwing grenades inside. And yes, there were two. In 2008, the Serena had its very ugly distinction that it became the first hotel to be attacked by the Taliban. Even the Norwegian foreign minister was there. In 2014, they attacked again. And what was it at that time? At least nine people died, including a much loved prominent Afghan journalist, Ahmed, with his brother, Ahmed Sardar, who was with his, just having an evening with his family to celebrate the Afghan New Year. So the walls kept getting higher, more and more walls of security around it, but it kept doing business for the city's elite and the visitors, of course.
And briefly then, Lise, what does today's news symbolize for you?
Well, it's not making much money. It must have been bleeding money. There's very few foreign visitors to Afghanistan, certainly not in the numbers that there used to be. The Taliban also run other hotels, and they want to see this as part of their, they believe they're doing a good job and that the world will come gradually, eventually, to Afghanistan's door. And they hope that the Serena door will be one of them.
Lise, many thanks for your insights. Our own Lise Doucette there. Now, storytellers from around the world have broken a world record by telling their tales continuously for more than 3 days. Performers from 33 countries took part in the event in the central square of the Moroccan capital, Marrakesh. They managed to stretch their plots across 80 hours and 34 minutes. It was part of the Marrakesh International Story Festival, which also included workshops in local schools. And our reporter, Richard Hamilton, was there.
This is the Jemaa el Fanar, the famous square right at the heart of the ancient Medina of Marrakesh. And it was here, 1,000 years ago, that storytellers began telling tales in the square. And this carried on for hundreds of years until, in the 1970s, as Moroccans got televisions, radios, then later the internet, social media, the young generation forgot about storytelling and it began to die out. But now, the Marrakesh International Storytelling Festival is trying to revive an interest in storytelling. As part of that, they're trying to break the record for the longest continuous storytelling session.
Bird's Nest spoke. Governor, I can only give you one advice. Be good. Just do good. And Bird's Nest said, Governor, a 5-year-old can understand this, but a 78-year-old still finds it difficult.
Do not do what Wee Tom did. Wee Tom was grabbed by the shoe with no lace in it, and he went out of the window and up into the air. Hi, 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 hi.
There was a wall
a stone wall made of fine old bricks. He has never seen a wall in this forest. It was something new, as if the wall appeared by magic. And then he discovered a door. And it was a fine carved door made of sandalwood. And the door was not closed, it was open.
My name is Brahim Daldali. I am a storyteller from Safru. A storytelling festival in Marrakesh has opened a big door for me to meet authors, to meet also academic people. So it's a huge opportunity for me. We teach young storytellers to be professional. So storytelling family starts growing.
I'm John Rowe, Artistic Director of the Marrakesh International Storytelling Festival.
How important is the festival in terms of reviving the tradition?
I prefer to call it a resuscitation because it never quite died, but it was in need of a little help. We're just one part of a process, I think, but a very important part. Bringing it back to the square, making it a spectacle again, because that was part of the problem. It was no longer a spectacle in the square. I stand up and say, ladies and gentlemen, assembled company, we are reclaiming the square for storytelling. The square was, for 1,000 years, had storytelling, and it was one of the most important parts of the square, apart from the 6,000 camels.
And that was John Rowe ending that report from Marrakesh by the BBC's Richard Hamilton. Well, they had more than 80 hours of storytelling. We only have 1 hour of news, and that is now coming to an end. So for me, James Kamara-Sami, and the rest of the team here in London, thanks very much for listening.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.